Good evening and welcome behind the news for November 2, 2006. This is Doug Henwood. We're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Almost all of tonight's show is given over to a long interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago with the prolific, lucid, and always enlightening Tariq Ali, the London-based writer whose latest book is Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope. We'll talk about the Middle East, the disaster the U.S. has made of Iraq, the defeat that Israel suffered in Lebanon, and, more hopefully, the challenge being mounted to neoliberal economics and U.S. dominance in Latin America. Before we get to that, a little business, and then some economic news. First, thanks to all of you who pledged during the recent fund drive, especially to those of you who pledged during my time slot, of course, but to all the rest of you as well. If you didn't pledge by credit card or automatic bank transfer, then please don't forget to send in your check. Year would keep us going, and not only financially. And now some economic news. It's been quite a while since I've done this, so there's some catching up to do. The big picture story is that the U.S. economy is slowing down. This is no doubt the result of the Federal Reserve's sustained campaign of raising interest rates. Though they've been on hold for the last few months, there were 17 consecutive increases in rates at their policymaking meetings, which they hold every 6 weeks. Adding to the drag is a sharp increase in energy prices, though that's been partially reversed since prices peaked in July. The oil prices are still quite high by the standards of the last 20 years, but in economics, changes often matter more than levels, especially when psychology is in play. Even though the average household spends just 3-4% of its after-tax income on gas, prices at the pump do have a heavy influence on people's perceptions of the economy. So moods have brightened somewhat. Bush's approval ratings on management of the economy have gone up, though they're still pretty mediocre. As I pointed out here before, Bush's approval rating is almost a perfect mirror image of the gas price. If prices rise, his approval fell, and vice versa. Not lately, though. His approval rating is still in the basement despite a sharp fall in the price of gas. Iraq, it seems, is finally dominating politics, as it should. And speaking of approval ratings, an amazing fact. A recent Wall Street Journal poll found Congress's approval rating at 16%, a remarkably low level rarely seen in political polls. That puts Congress just below Michael Jackson, who has an 18% approval rating according to Gallup, and just above Paris Hilton at 15%. In other economic news, the housing bubble continues to lose air. It seems builders are selling new houses, but only by cutting prices and offering other incentives like free vacations in some instances. And since U.S. consumers had derived a lot of their spending juice from housing, either because they felt richer when prices were rising or because they were borrowing several hundred billion a year against rising home equity values, the declining real estate market is showing up in weakening retail sales. Of special interest, once mighty Walmart has hit a wall, with sales barely growing and its stock price languishing. Walmart has been trying to move upscale to generate new growth since it's pretty much saturated the rural heartland, but it's not working out very well. They meet protests when they try to open urban stores, and their attempts at fashion are not going over very well. Couldn't happen to a nicer company. One reason that consumer spending has been so housing-dependent is that jobs and income have not been growing like gangbusters, and that slow pace of growth has been getting slower. Tomorrow brings the release of the October jobs data, and I'm not expecting much. Modest job and wage growth, continuing a trend that's a lot weaker than the 1990s or even the 1980s. The U.S. economy is stumbling. Even the great productivity boom, which for ordinary people meant that they were putting out more product in every hour of work while seeing no pay increases, meaning fatter profits for the boss, that too is stumbling. This morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported no productivity growth last quarter. Even the bright spots are growing dim. Okay, enough of the dismal science. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Tariq Ali. That was an excerpt from Franz Schubert's impromptu D-946 No. 1, performed by the pianist Alfred Brendel. More of that a little later in the program. And now the first part of an interview with Tariq Ali. Tariq is the author of a dozen books on history and politics, a half a dozen novels and scripts for stage and screen. His latest book is Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, a study of Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, Evo Morales, president of Bolivia, and Fidel Castro, who needs no further identification. The book is just out from Verso. Tariq has also written and spoken extensively in the Middle East, which is where we begin. Tariq Ali. Welcome, Tariq. First, let's start talking about the Middle East before we turn to a more hopeful region of the world. The Bush administration's grand plans to remake the political map of the Middle East seem to be a total failure, and few people besides Christopher Hitchens now holding on to the faith. How's it look to you?
Well, the U.S. administration's policy in the Middle East is totally in shreds. There is no other word or phrase to describe it. And it has now become obvious to the U.S. military establishment and its military colleagues in Britain that Iraq is a complete disaster. The press tends to publicize intra-Iraqi conflicts between Shia and Sunni groups, which obviously do happen and take place. But what they underplay is the constant assaults on the occupation forces. U.S. casualties last month were 59 soldiers killed and over 100 or 200 wounded, which is a very, very high figure and the highest U.S. casualty figures for any month. So the military men running the war in Iraq know exactly what's going on, and they see no end in sight, and they see no light at the end of the tunnel, and they want out. And just a couple of weeks ago, General Sir Mark Danet, the commander-in-chief of the British Army, no less, serving general in the British Army, made a public statement in which he said the situation in Iraq is out of control and Britain should withdraw its troops.
He was forced to revise that statement quite quickly.
He was forced to revise that statement, and they put a spin on it. But the very fact, Doug, that he made this statement created a total political crisis in that country, I can tell you that. Because it's unheard of. U.S. generals have a tradition, a long, long tradition of speaking out, right or wrong, and going for the politicians. I mean, MacArthur did it with Truman in Korea, and you know, there are other examples. But in Britain, this tradition does not exist. The generals are totally subordinate to the politicians. So the fact that Mark Danet said it, obviously they've, you know, pleaded with him to retract, and he did to a certain extent. But what he said is believed by a large section of the British political and military establishment. You have had a number of figures, ambassadors, ex-ambassadors in the Foreign Office, former intelligence chiefs, Blair's former national security advisor, who have been vicious, absolutely vicious about British involvement in Iraq. And Blair's former national security advisor recently wrote a piece in the Financial Times after Blair's last visit to Bush during the Lebanese fiasco. And he wrote in the FT that he said, "Who is this zombie who suddenly reaches our shores from yet another visit to the United States and speaks like a total robot?" I mean, just savage attack. So there's no doubt that it's a mess, it's a crisis for them, and they have no option but to pull out sooner or later. The only question is whether they will pull out before the country is divided or wait for the split to happen, try and institutionalize it in some way, keep some part of the country for a military base, and then pull out. That's the only question which is preoccupying them.
But of course, this is a country with very large oil reserves, surrounded by lots of other oil reserves. Can they afford to pull out from an imperial point of view?
They can. It's difficult for them to conceive this, because there is no doubt it would be seen in the eyes of the American public and the world as a big defeat if they're forced to pull out. So they will probably try and look for ways to cover up the defeat by saying, well, at least we gave the Kurds their freedom, which is what some of their more craven apologists say. And they will say, well, we have something there, and try and establish relations with the post-occupation regime, which will give them some access to the oil. What the Israelis are telling them quite publicly is that even if you pull out, you have to leave three large big bases in there, military bases. Now, whether an Iraqi government will agree to this or not is an open question. They might agree to it temporarily and put a time limit on it and say, okay, let's negotiate a withdrawal, but you keep a temporary U.S. military presence till 2010. I don't know, but all these discussions are going on. The thing is that once the occupation armies proper are withdrawn from that country, the whole relationship of forces will change very, very rapidly. And what they've done, in effect, they hate to be told this, but what they have done is to strengthen Iran enormously. And Iran now becomes a very major regional player. And the pressure on them to try and neuter Iran before they leave comes not only from Israel, which is sort of well known, but behind the scenes it also comes from the Saudi Kingdom and some of the Gulf states who say, do something before you go because we don't want to be left with a very strong Iran. So my own feeling is they will not attack Iran. But in any
having botched Iraq so badly, I mean, Iran is a much harder nut to crack, so they couldn't, unless they're totally insane, they couldn't.
They can't, and this is why there's some, you know, people keep on going on about Iran is going to be invaded, etc. I mean, people, progressive people, and I have been arguing against that very strongly. A, because it would be completely insane and irrational. B, because they haven't got the men on the ground if it reaches a stage where they have to fight on another front. Thirdly, if they just decide to bomb the nuclear reactor as a display of machismo, the Iranians are publicly saying that we will not fight them in Iran, we will fight them in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we will unravel those two occupations so quickly that they won't know what's hit them. Now, the Iranians are saying this publicly. The Pentagon knows this extremely well, so I don't think any neocon lunacy is going to succeed. Even if they want it, it's not going to happen. The military in the United States will probably block that option very clearly if they haven't already sealed it off. So from every point of view, the war in Iraq has turned out to be a disaster. It has strengthened the country they regard as an enemy state, Iran. It has destabilized the Middle East. And it was followed, the disaster in Iraq, by the disaster in Lebanon. So, in fact, U.S. standing in the region is now weaker than it's been for a long, long time.
I want to return to Israel and Lebanon in a second, but Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, has a piece in a forthcoming Foreign Affairs about the new Middle East. And one of the things he says is that Iran is a classical imperial power. That's its ambitions, a very ambitious desire for control in the region. What's your reading of Iran's book?
It's nonsense to say that Iran is an imperial power. It hasn't been an imperial power since the 17th century. I mean, you know, it's just a joke that it's like saying Turkey is an imperial power because it once was part of the, you know, grand old Ottoman Empire. I think Iran's ambitions are regional ambitions to be seen as a strong regional power and to be respected for what it is. And there is absolutely no doubt that the Shia groups in Iraq, even though there are differences, we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking just because they're Shias, they'll do deals with the Iranians just like that. There are differences between the Persians and the Arabs, and Shiaism doesn't necessarily transcend those differences. But nonetheless, there's absolutely no doubt about it that a Shia-dominated government in Iraq with a after the occupation, will be very tempted to do all sorts of deals with Iran. Both countries have oil. Both countries have had security problems. So I think economic, trade, and security pacts, non-aggression pacts, and pacts to come to each other's aid if they're attacked by anyone else, will happen. So you will have an Iraq-Iran nexus in the region, which will be extremely strong indeed. But beyond that, I don't think the Iranians will go. Now, obviously, it's not impossible that the fact that the United States has suffered a big setback in the region, which is obvious to everyone in that part of the world, could trigger off sooner rather than later uprisings in some of the peninsular states and in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, the obsession of the United States is that if we stop backing the kleptocrats who rule that country, Al-Qaeda will take over. I think there's no doubt that Al-Qaeda are strong in Saudi Arabia, but what people never talk about is the fact that Al-Qaeda represents the Wahhabi core of the population. It does not speak and could not speak for 40-45% of the population of Saudi Arabia who are Shia and who have had this Wahhabi code imposed on them since Roosevelt did a deal with the Saudi kings and the British before him in the 20s and 30s of the 40s of the last century. And these Shia people, population in Saudi Arabia are not happy. And what will be the effect of a strong Iran combined with Iraq on them is an open question, and that is what makes the Saudi royal family and the Saudi establishment very nervous, and that is something which, of course, no policymaker in the United States even considered, because when they think Saudi Arabia, they think royal family and Al-Qaeda, but there are other people there.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, the London-based writer and political analyst, who is the author most recently of Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, just out from Verso.
And what about the domestic prospects of the Iranian regime? There's a lot of discontent about 20-plus years of rule by the mullahs. Ahmadinejad uses a lot of populist economic language, but I'm not quite sure how much content there is to his agenda. What do you read about their popularity, their future, their stability?
Well, you know, whether people like it or not, Ahmadinejad is popular, and it's important to understand why he's popular. The reason for the popularity is the economic promises. The last election campaign that was fought in Iran was an election campaign in which religion or religious ideology played absolutely no part at all. I have never seen, and I followed that election and the statements that were made, I have never seen a campaign in recent times anywhere in the world which was so dominated by class. Ahmadinejad spoke for the poor, defended the poor, did it quite effectively because his own origins are, comes from a very large family of poverty-stricken slum dwellers, more or less. Regarded as completely honest. And the most devastating weapon that he used in the election campaign, which shows that he's not totally dumb, is they hired very good filmmakers who went and filmed Rafsanjani's properties, his apartments, how much money he'd made, and these videos were distributed all over Iran. And he said, this is the choice. Either you have a fat cat who may be a cleric, but he's corrupt, he's rich, or you vote for someone who will try and do something for you. And this was the division in Iranian politics at the time of the last election. Ahmadinejad's opponent, backed by the West, who, you know, backed a rival cleric, Rafsanjani, totally believes in the Washington consensus, in neoliberal economics, promised the West that he would do deals with them, and was helped by Western public relations firms who went and orchestrated his election campaign with rah-rah girls and the hijabbed rah-rah girls roaming around Tehran. And the thing backfired sensationally. That's the big divide. Now, in terms of foreign policy, the clerics basically say, behind the scenes and increasingly in public, or one faction of the clerics, without us, the Americans could never have taken Iraq. Without us, they could not have occupied Afghanistan. Our tacit agreement for them to do it helped them to do it, so why are they turning on us now on this nuclear question? We haven't even decided to build nuclear weapons. All we're doing is enriching uranium. Everyone else around our part of the world does it. So why are they turning on us? Because the occupation of our neighboring country, which we tacitly supported, has gone wrong for them because they've blown it. So this is what they ask in private. And Ahmadinejad's decision to make a fight on the nuclear question, there is absolutely no doubt, has united the bulk of the country behind him. I mean, when Shirin Ebadi, who got the Nobel Peace Prize, says publicly, on this question, I support the government, you have to ask what the hell is going on. And so I think it's an interesting situation, but there is no opposition from the left or from progressive forces, because they are very weak in Iran. So what you have is Ahmadinejad, who represents populist economics, radical language, and who is now beginning to say that there's a divide within the clerical layers between me, who wants to help the poor, and the fat cats, who will not let me clean up the corrupt oil ministry. This is what he says in private. You know, I want to do a cleanup operation. They won't let me touch the oil ministry, which is a nest of corruption, and people are building private fortunes. So in this situation, anything could happen in that country. You know, it's not at all impossible that the Khamenei and people will get very fed up and try and remove Ahmadinejad, because he's a thorn in their side, because he's completely someone you can't predict what he's going to say next.
Does he have the resources or the political base to deliver on any of his economic populism?
I think that's his big problem, that in order to do that, he has to pick up a big fight with the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and with his backers. And these are very cautious, socially conservative people who do not want to shake anything, because they fear that if we make any concessions, the whole structure we have erected in Iran over the last 20, 25 years could collapse around our feet. It's classic bureaucratic response. We don't make any changes which will change too much. We have the country more or less under control, to which Ahmadinejad says to them, if we do nothing to help the poor, we could have other forms of revolutions taking place in the country, because conditions are really bad. Then you have a tiny layer of middle and upper middle class people, and a layer of the intelligentsia, who prior to the disaster in Iraq used to say, why don't the Americans come in and sort these guys out for us as well? Now, after the disaster in Iraq, even this layer, very pro the US, says, no, we don't want them to come here, because they see what's happening next door. So it's a situation where at the moment there is no real option to the current setup. I mean, the kids are angry with Khatami, saying he promised a lot and he delivered nothing. Interestingly enough, there's been a fight between Ahmadinejad and the hardline clerics, because, you know, the issues on which these guys pick up a fight, it's like Kremlinology used to be in the old days. You have to see what's going on. Ahmadinejad made a decision as president saying that women can go to football matches, which surprised everyone, because they thought he's a hardline ruler. He said, you know, what's wrong with that? What's this got to do with the Quran? Well, why shouldn't women go and enjoy a football match? So that's been a change decision. Then he said that the religious police shouldn't be deciding how women should wear the hijab. As long as they wear it, it's in their modestly dressed, that's fine. They don't have to go, there are no rules. On which the hardcore clerics attacked him from the right and said, no, this is absolutely wrong. All their heads have to be covered. You know, some of these women are defying us by wearing the hijab and flaunting it in a... All this nonsense goes on all the time, but gives indications of some of the social tensions in the country. If Ahmadinejad was clever, which, you know, he will not break from this way of looking at things, and he ended the social control on the everyday lives of the people, women especially, his popularity would soar. But he's not going to do that, because that he might lose other parts of his base. But that's what is needed. You know, Iran really needs is desperately in need of social and economic reforms, and whoever does them will be king for a long time.
Let's turn to another humble to power, Israel, whose adventure in Lebanon did not turn out as planned. What's the result now? What is the standing of Israel's regional power?
This has been, in some ways, Doug, in my opinion, the most amazing development in that region. Because the United States in Iraq, you know, it's a sort of everyone knows that if the United States really wanted to destroy the country, they could do it in a flash, you know, just bomb everything into oblivion. So what they are suffering in Iraq is a big political disaster. But what the Israelis suffered in Lebanon was a military setback of a sort they had really not suffered for a very, very long time. They were sure that they were going to win. They were sure that they knew where Hezbollah was. They were sure that they were going to wipe it out. And they failed on every single front. And as they failed and realized that they were not succeeding, they went into a blind rage like a crazed elephant and destroyed everything inside, destroyed the social infrastructure of that country, hoping from their point of view that if they do this, people would blame Hezbollah and begin to say, there they are. I mean, how can they think like that?
The cluster bombs are not signed Hezbollah.
Exactly. The cluster bombs, the civilian casualties, the women and children dying, which was not shown on American networks, but was certainly shown all over the Europe and the rest of the world. So the American citizens are the only people who were not shown these images on their television. Everyone else was, all over the globe, including, I may add, inside Israel itself. So one of the largest anti-war demonstrations that we saw was in Tel Aviv, where 50,000 Israelis came out and demanded peace and said this is not what this state was created for, was to go and kill innocent women and children and make war on neighboring countries. But the setback, I think, has done two things. Now, look, again, if you see who greenlighted Israel's invasion of Lebanon, the United States, obviously, Britain, we know, did, and that created another crisis for Blair. But within the region, Israel's decision to go in was green-lighted by the Saudis and by the Jordanians, without any doubt at all, because they were hoping that if Hezbollah was defeated, all this idea of irregular popular militias, which was doing the rounds in the Arab world, would be crushed. It would be a big blow for the Shia, because Hezbollah represents the poor Shia population in Lebanon. So they were hoping that the Israelis would succeed as well. And this imbecilical king of Jordan is stupid enough, when the Israelis failed, he actually made a statement to the effect saying, oh my God, you know, what a mistake this has been. Sort of disappointed, but realizing it's a big crisis for us all. I mean, what the defeat has done within the Middle East is it has projected Nasrullah, who was formerly seen just exclusively as a sectarian warlord, which was a mistake, by the way, because he was always more than that, but it has now projected him as a leader of the Arab nation. I mean, you have seen demonstrations in Cairo carrying portraits of Nasrullah and Nasser. His prestige now is at a peak in the Arab world. In Lebanon, the effect has been amazing, because what we were going to see, what we were witnessing in the Lebanon after the Syrian withdrawal, was a big vacuum in the country. And the question was, who would fill the vacuum after the Syrians? The United States decided the Israelis should fill it, basically, and Lebanon should become an Israeli-American protectorate, just like Jordan. That was the plan, that was the Israeli, what the cause of the Israeli invasion was, and that has failed. But no Syrian group, including Hezbollah, called on the Syrians or the Iranians for help, or sent troops, help us. None of them did it. Nasrullah didn't do it. Actually, Nasrullah said, we have to depend on our own strength to defeat these people. So the ironic development has been that for the first time in its entire existence, since the French carved out a slice of Syria and may called it Lebanon when they were leaving, there is now a Lebanese nationalism which has united the country. So you have the Christian population, which historically the West used as their sort of people in the region. 60% of the Christian population of Lebanon, immediately after the ceasefire, said they supported Hezbollah. Sunnis said, a majority said, we support Nasrullah and Hezbollah. The government is in a total crisis. It doesn't know what to do, which is why Nasrullah is calling for new elections. saying, let's have new elections and choose a government which can defend our country against all invaders. This government failed to do it. When the defense minister was asked during the Israeli war, what is your opinion on Hezbollah? He said, well, they're fighting well, because they are the resistance. And the journalist said, yeah, they are fighting well, but what about your army? And he kept replying, but Hezbollah is the resistance. But, you know, it's just become a complete joke. Within Israel, this has created a very big backlash now. I think if there's an election tomorrow in Israel, this regime would be defeated. God knows who they'd elect. But these people would be defeated. The generals and politicians have been openly attacking each other. The public is extremely angry. But underlying it, Doug, is another trend, which I certainly noted. I haven't written about it. I don't know. Someone should write about it. Which is this, that the kids they sent in to fight, these young raw conscripts they sent in to fight in Lebanon, are not your hardened ideological Zionists which fought your wars in 48, 67, 73, 82. These are basically kids produced by a globalized neoliberal system and its impact in Israel. Most of the time they spend, when they are not in the army, playing computer games and, seeing porno movies and internet cafes and going shopping and, picking up.
Members of the global slacker class.
Exactly. Exactly right. That is who they are. Suddenly, they're told, prepare, we're going into Lebanon, and they have to fight a real war. And they are totally incapable of doing it. That, for me, is one explanation of why the Israeli army failed. That they're completely, the neoliberal culture dominates that country. And these kids have no idea what we're doing there. And when they have a tough resistor, it's fine if you, bomb from the air. But when you send in ground troops and you face an actually tough and an intelligent classic guerrilla resistance, they had no idea what they were going to do. The reports which have been published in the Israeli press of the chaos and confusion inside the Israeli army is very revealing. And that will be worrying the Israeli high command and their friends in the Pentagon, saying, God, we thought this was one of our most reliable relays in the region. And if they can't take over a tiny little country and defeat a very small guerrilla force, what are we going to do?
That was the first part of an interview with the London-based writer and political analyst Tariq Ali. Let's take a break for Station ID, and we'll be back.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio.
And we're back. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And now, a little musical break, and we'll return with Tariq Ali. And that was another excerpt from Franz Schubert's Impromptu D-946 No. 1, performed by Alfred Brendel. And now let's return to the interview with Tariq Ali, which I recorded a couple of weeks ago. Before I ask the next question, I do want to clarify what your thinking is about the U.S.-Israeli relation. If you read, certainly, a lot of right-wing sources, but even read Counterpunch, there's an idea that Israel manipulates U.S. policy, that Congress is Israeli-occupied territory is one of the contributors to Counterpunch. But what do you think of that?
Look, there is no doubt that the Israeli influence within the United States is at its peak. And this has happened post 9/11. Prior to that, they were a close ally. It's the conjunction of 9/11, the neocon capture of the Republican Party, etc., which has created this conjunctural situation. But despite all that, I see it like this. There's no doubt that their influence is very strong with the administration. But the notion that the United States, the world's most powerful empire, the only empire, is pushed into doing something because one of its satrapies wants it to, is something I can't totally buy, actually, because it goes against the grain of every empire. Empires, whether it's the United States or previous empires, act in their own interests. You can say that sometimes, and quite often, they misread their own interests. They make big, big mistakes. But they never go in to defend someone else's interests where these interests don't totally coincide with their own. So I have never been a great believer of this. You know, it's a sort of conspiracy theory. There's an aspect of it which is like that. That the Israelis are capable of getting the United States to do A, B, and C. They are not. No power on the world is. If the American elite, military, political elite, feels that something it's going to do is going to completely destroy its own interests, regardless of the involvement of any other, it will not do it. There is no... Someone has to prove to me, and I don't believe that the war in Iraq was fought just because the Israelis wanted to get rid of Saddam. I mean, you know, that's not the case. They've been fighting that war for some time. Then there was a coherent, though completely wrong reason for it, which was to show that U.S. hegemony in an oil-producing region is protected by taking over a country which we've already more or less destroyed and transforming it into a model state as an example of the other region. It's total nonsense, but that was the plan, and they actually thought they could do it, and they didn't. Now, the Israelis were quite happy with that for reasons of their own, but the notion that they pushed them into doing it, I mean, they supported them. So I don't go along with that. I think the most appalling role of AIPAC and all these pro-Israel groups is domestically inside the United States, and that is to try and stop any real discussion of Israel-Palestine or what the Israelis are doing to oppositionists in their own country, and to make sure that Israel is a protected area inside the political mind of the American population. I think that is very insidious, which is why, and you know, they give lots of money to Democrats and Republicans, etc., and they vote for them in the Congress and give them support. So in terms of Israel itself, that's very clear what they do, but the notion that they actually determine U.S. policy is not something I buy. It doesn't make sense.
Right now, with the U.S. suffering a big defeat in Iraq, and it's hard to call it anything else now, and Israel suffering a defeat in Lebanon, what does this mean for the whole, you know, kind of imperial structure of the world right now? Is the U.S. and its Israeli ally, it's probably its most important and powerful ally around the world, with them both in the ropes or suffering some kind of defeat, does this weaken the hierarchy which has been governing the world at least since the end of the Cold War?
I think it weakens it politically. It weakens its ability to control and dominate the world. But I think it would be a mistake to see the setbacks in Iraq and Lebanon, which are, you know, as we've just said, very, very important and significant, to deduce from this that the American empire is on its last legs, or that the global system is going to collapse very soon. That doesn't follow. What does follow, and what could happen, is that the world created by the United States after the collapse of communism a world which we can describe as something very equivalent to what the European reactionary powers in Europe tried to do after the defeat of the French Revolution and the end of the Napoleonic Wars, was to create a concert of Europe, to create a new order and to prevent any radical outbreaks, just saying we're not going to allow this to happen, we've got France back. There was that side of developments which the United States pushed through. The basic policies of the United States over the last 100 years or since 1917 were a twin-track policy, one to make sure that it was a dominant power in the system of international states, and secondly to use this power to extend the capitalist world market to the farthest corners of the globe and take the globe for capitalism. Well, they achieved that aim. China today is the new workshop of the world, producing the most dynamic capitalism we've seen for a long time. China is interlocked. Its economy is interlocked with that of the United States. Japan, another economically strong power, has not allowed its own foreign policy. Korean reunification is delayed to try and stop any Far Eastern bloc emerging. The other big bloc, if you look, as the European Union, which is in total and complete crisis. The expansion of the European Union, pushed through by the United States and Britain, has actually weakened it as a political entity. Economically, it is going along with the United States. And if you look at the world, you will see that 60% of the world's population lives in the United States, China, the European Union, Japan, Brazil, and India. 60% of the population and 80% of the world's GDP comes out of this big chunk of the world. This world, China, India, the European Union, are not shaking at all. In fact, the continent, the entire, taking out the Middle East, the continent of Asia is pretty stable, with the exception of the uprising in Nepal. All the two big blocs in Asia, China, the Far Eastern sector, India, South Asia, there are no economic challenge coming to the United States at all. So they have suffered severe setbacks, there's no doubt about it, which will weaken them politically. But the only continent which is showing signs of challenging U.S. imperial and economic hegemony, which is what really matters, not military struggles, is Latin America. That is what makes that continent very interesting. And if Brazil and Mexico fell, then the United States elite would be in serious trouble.
I'm speaking of Tariq Ali, the London-based writer and political analyst who is the author most recently of Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, just out from Verso.
Well, you made my transition for me because that's what I wanted to start talking about. Fidel Castro looks rather ill, perhaps terminally so, and the future of Cuba, maybe a little murky, but on the other hand, Chavez looks pretty strong. First of all, what's your evaluation of Chavez and the use of oil money for domestic development and that sort of thing? Is it working out, and how secure do you see his political future?
Well, I've been sort of visiting Venezuela now for several years and been observing the developments in that country quite closely. And I think there is no doubt that the poor in Venezuela, which is a large bulk of the country, are by and large pretty solidly behind him. They sometimes get a bit bored with politics, but they are behind him. And if push comes to shove, they will support Chavez against the local oligarchy. This despite the fact that you have all the major newspapers and private television channels constantly spewing out propaganda against him. And I always say to friends in other parts of the world, sometimes we give the corporate media too much attention, because what Venezuela shows is that if you have politicians with vision who actually push through social programs and reforms, the media can't totally stop that. They can attack, they can do that, but they've had nil impact in bringing about a shift in favor of the oligarchy since 2002. They've tried coups, they've tried middle-class strikes, they've tried to wreck the country. Each time he's emerged stronger. So the reforms which he's pushed through of using the oil money to create what are essentially, you know, people in the States sometimes get shocked when I say this. I say, well, look, you know, he is very radical in terms of attacking imperialism and all that. But the internal reforms which are taking place in Venezuela today are a combination of the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal, and social democratic reforms which were pushed through in every European country after the Second World War.
Is this what he means by 21st century socialism?
Yeah, that's what he means. I mean, it's left social democratic reforms. And he says, he said it to me a number of times, we are not living in an epoch of proletarian revolutions. It's crazy to think you can just jump over everything and do that. We've got to learn some lessons from the past. And so we are proceeding very cautiously in building up new structures, etc. Now, there are problems with that, but actually they're good problems of trying to work out what you can do. And it's precisely because the combination has been repeated elections through democratic means of Chavez and the Bolivarians, combined with social reforms, which has created a big pole of attraction in the whole of Latin America. Where the Cubans have been extremely important is not in ideological terms, but in helping out with the enormous reserves of human capital that Cuba has accumulated over years. So when there's a middle class strike and doctors and teachers try and destabilize the regime, I said to Chavez, I said, you know, when did you feel the most concerned that everything could crack up? He said, I was sure when the U.S. pushed through a coup d'etat against me, we'd win, because I knew the soldiers would never tolerate it and the poor wouldn't tolerate it. I wasn't worried. But he said, when the middle classes did the strike like they did against Allende in Chile, I got nervous, because, you know, that affects the lives of all our people. And I thought we might lose support and there could be trouble. But he said it didn't happen, and he talked about it to me, where he went into the slums and people said to him, don't give up now, don't let these guys screw you, we're behind you, we're not going to falter. And he said he then rang up Castro, and Castro talked him through and said, no, you know, we don't need any provocative measures, we've had one Allende in this continent, that's enough, we don't need more martyrs, so proceed cautiously, how can we help, what do you need? And Chavez said, you know, our hospitals are closed down. And he said, within 2 weeks, 14,500 Cuban doctors arrived with equipment, with medicines, and set up clinics in the poorest areas of the country. And in many of these areas, of course, Chavez has majority support, but the oligarchy has its supporters too. And even supporters of the oligarchy said, we have never had medical treatment as good as this in our entire lives. That, and then teachers poured in from Cuba and Latin America, and the schools started running again, and they got a better education. That created a psychological impact on the country, which it's difficult to quantify. And he, Chavez, of course, being Chavez, boasted about it and said, you know, Cuban doctors have come in. The oligarchy said to people, don't go to these doctors. The private television channels were saying they're not really doctors, they're terrorists. They've come to recruit you. Well, you know, absurdity. People are being treated free of charge. Eye operations are being... I mean, the whole thing was transformed. So that has been extremely popular. The problem there... Doug, the problem there is that will Chavez succeed in creating political structures which, you know, it's difficult this, which empower the people, and which, so that even if the worst happens, which many people fear, and someone bumps him off, the process survives. And to that, my honest answer is, I do not know. I mean, I don't think they've succeeded in creating these structures as yet. There is a tremendous problem and shortage of thinking people, cadres, good, strong people around him. The process, for me, is very important, but it's still too dependent on the popularity of one person, and that is worrying.
What about his ability to create a broader regional influence? The right in recent elections in Ecuador and Mexico has been able to tar the left candidates with the Chavez Association. It seemed to damage their electoral fate. So Is this an obstacle? Is he being bogeyized by around the region?
He is being bogeyized by the pro-neoliberal oligarchies and pro-US politicians throughout the region. But this can work both ways. We will see what happens in the runoff in the Ecuadorian election. It's not totally impossible that the candidate of the left, who openly identifies with the Bolivarians, wins. I mean, we will see. So it has this dual impact, and the oligarchs hate it. On the other hand, the poor are mobilized to come out and vote, which normally they tend not to do. And Morales's victory in Bolivia, there's no doubt Morales was very open. He said, you know, I'm part of the Bolivarian project, and I support the Venezuelans and the Cubans. And I mean, for Morales to do what he did after his election victory, he hopped on a plane and flew to Havana, where he got a six-hour tutorial from the jefe himself on Latin America, on strategy, tactics in the region. It's quite astonishing. And Morales is now having a big impact in Peru. So I think the situation in Peru remains unstable. Mexico, of course, is a big domino. And if that were to fall, there would be a big crisis for U.S. foreign policy in that region. And it fell, according to all the reports you've read, by the guys who run these amazingly named but very, very good indie media journals like Narco News. Al Giordano, writing in Narco News, he's a Zapatista, so he didn't even want to participate in the election campaign. But the most amazing reports I've read of the Mexican election campaign were in some of these independent outlets, just proving beyond doubt that the state had rigged the elections. Rigged them quite cleverly, but rigged them without any shadow of a doubt to prevent AMLO, López Obrador, from winning the elections. And if you read the article in Foreign Affairs by Castaneda, the former foreign minister of Mexico, he writes, he says, the big problem we face in Mexico is that if Obrador wins, in terms of foreign policy, he will support the radical bloc which exists of Bolivia, Cuba, Venezuela, and which is expanding. And that will be a big blow for the United States, so we have to do everything to stop him from winning. And he's more intelligent than some of them, and he says, my advice, therefore, to the Mexican elite is steal some of Obrador's economic clothes and the populist measures he's advocating and make them our own in order to defeat him. But they didn't go long. I mean, you know, they basically stopped him winning by rigging the elections. So we will see. I mean, Mexico is in quite a volatile state, volatile mood at the moment. So the fact that Obrador has lost doesn't mean that things have calmed down there at all. And that's the interesting development. And if you look at the world globally, this is the only continent where social movements have emerged from below, from the early 90s onwards, and produced parties, leaders different from the past, and which are challenging neoliberal economics. That challenge of you know, producing social visionaries is not coming from the Middle East. I mean, they are doing other things and resisting occupations. But a political challenge which can have an impact on the population of the United States, which is the most important thing in the world as far as I'm concerned, is coming from Latin America. Which is why, I mean, Chavez can sometimes go over the top. I mean, I don't think he should have called Bush an alcoholic, for instance. I mean, who cares? But referring to Mark Twain and Martin Luther King and saying, these are Americans I love and respect and revere, that is intelligent thinking. Trying to create a divide within the United States by offering cheap oil to the poor sections of the community, that is clever thinking. Offering help to New Orleans, the Cubans offered doctor, the Venezuelans offered, you know, whatever was needed, that is a clever way of thinking. And so what happens in Latin America impacts much more on the United States and much more quickly than anything that happens in the Middle East.
And that was the second part of an interview with the London-based author and political analyst Tariq Ali, recorded a couple of weeks ago. His latest book is called Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, just out from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and all into the evening. And let's go out with a little bit more Schubert. Till next week. Bye.